From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what could Michigan's leaders and businesses learn from the bustling business climate in Israel?
Government doesn't have to be the enemy. One of the things we saw in Israel is they can be a catalyst to change, and they can support change in strategic ways.
Why do millennials have such a self-image problem?
It's remarkable. Everybody is trying to be something else, and then almost in order to then hate on the millennial structure.
And we meet a woman who's tracked down and photographed every single post office in the Upper Peninsula.
They do have a personality, and they reflect the personality of the towns that they're in. And
plus, what's with the nice low gas prices, and how long will it last? Those stories and much more today on Stateside. A new poll finds older generations overwhelmingly describe themselves as patriotic, hardworking, responsible. But those numbers go way down when millennials describe themselves.
The context that a lot of people in my generation are living through is a context of precarity. It's a context of you don't really know what's going to happen next.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why do millennials have such a self-image problem? But first, things are pretty quiet in Lansing this week as lawmakers continue their autumn break. But post-Thanksgiving, look for the focus to be trained on Detroit schools, and with it, a thorny political challenge for Governor Snyder. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team. Welcome you two.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
So we recap exactly what it is Governor Snyder wants to do to overhaul Detroit public schools and what it's expected to cost.
Sure. So, of course, Detroit public schools really under crippling debt right now. Really horrible financial picture. And so similar to the auto rescue, right, with General Motors, where there was an old GM and thus out of, you know, the ashes came the new GM. The governor is saying, hey, what if we did something like that with the Detroit schools, basically an old district that would assume the debt and then create a new district in the city that would take care just of educating the kids, the students. And we're looking at a price tag upwards of about $700 million, $500 million, so half a billion to take on the DPS debt, and then about $200 million to create this new school district.
And Rick, what does Governor Snyder believe would happen if something isn't done to tackle the DPS debt?
Well, I guess there are a couple things here. One is certainly a critical aspect of Rick Snyder's legacy is going to be what happens in Detroit. And the turnaround of Detroit really can't succeed without a turnaround of Detroit's public schools, which has just been a quagmire going back to Governor John Engler, maybe before. You know, others have tried and others have failed. But, you know, the grand bargain, the Detroit bankruptcy, could all be for naught if it's not a city where people want to raise their families and send their kids to school.
And he's pretty much taking flack from all sides for this plan. So let's break down and see who's resisting and why. Let's start with Detroit lawmakers, Zoe.
Yeah, and that has to do with a bit of control. And as Rick and I talked about, and it's just politics today, it's not just philanthropic groups, which talked a little bit about this. We can talk about this in a moment, but also Detroit lawmakers going, hey, you know what? DPS has been under state-appointed control for different emergency managers in 6 years. And how has that worked out?
Sort of a you broke it, you bought it syndrome here, where they're saying that you know, the problem here is that the state isn't providing the money necessary, the cash necessary to really educate the students. And so what they want is for the state to write a check, and they want control restored to the Board of Education, which has a lot of Republicans in particular just saying no way.
And let's talk about lawmakers. Certainly after the Detroit grand bargain and now money going to help address Flint's lead and water crisis, it's pretty fair, isn't it, to think that state lawmakers have a pretty good case of bailout fatigue?
Exactly the phrase I was going to use, that you know, we're talking about a lot of money here, a great deal of money here. And they've already been called to the well a couple of times, and it's not like the state's budget is quite flush yet. And so what Governor Snyder has to do is start moving the pieces around so that everybody sees a benefit, and enough of a benefit that they decide that they can take what for a lot of lawmakers would be a pretty tough vote.
Very tough vote. educational community. We've got reaction from charter schools, and I can tell you both that yesterday I had someone come up to me at the mall and say thank you to Stateside for what you do talking about the school situation and Detroit Public Schools. Mm-hmm. She is a Detroit Public School teacher, and she said, if we go to Old Co., New Co., I won't see the end of my career. I will be leaving. So clearly teachers are leery of this too.
Right. And I think as you brought up charters, I mean, one of the issues that they're concerned about is again, going back to that word control, that right now how it's talking about, this would give the ability to just close down certain schools.
Part of the governor's plan is this, you know, Detroit school czar who would have this sweeping authority
to appointed by him.
Yeah. Or
Mayor Duggan.
Exactly.
What about foundations and nonprofits? You touched on that, Zoe.
Right. And that just goes to this idea that they are being looked at now for some cash. As you mentioned, it's what happened in the Detroit Grand Bargain. It is what happened in the Flint water crisis. And now folks looking, saying, hey, if we are going to see some kind of rescue package for Detroit, where are these nonprofits? Where are the foundations? And some of the foundations and philanthropic organizations pushing back, as I said, going, hey, you know, not only have we been under emergency management, that the state has been in control, but another thing they'll say is, look, we are putting money into the situation,
right,
that we've already spent tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars, and we are planning on continuing to do so.
In quiet ways that are not full spotlight.
That the governor isn't saying, write this check right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, what they want is for the money to be going into classrooms so that they can show results in terms of test scores and things like that, and not merely whittling down a mountain of debt from the old school district.
Rick, what kind of political balancing act does Rick Snyder have to pull off to get his DPS rescue plan off the ground?
Look, it's always a numbers game, and it's 56 votes in the House, 19 votes in the Senate, and something that the governor can find acceptable. And one of the problems that he's facing, that he's faced before and he will face with the DPS conundrum, is how do you come up with something that is, you know, ultimately value added, that you bring in more votes than you drop off with any, you know, compromise that you create. You know, one interesting one is, you know, Detroit teachers don't like it because of what it does to, you know, they're not happy with the contracts that are being imposed upon them right now. That Detroit legislators have a problem. Outstate legislators have a problem. School districts have a problem, outstate school districts, because this would take money from the school aid fund. But there may actually be room for a compromise there, in that some superintendents are saying, well, hey, if we can secure a promise that the state will never again raid the school aid fund for higher education, that this will be devoted to K-12 schools, then maybe we could come on board. When Governor Rick Snyder first did this, it was basically a budget balancing act that he pulled off. I don't think that he ever suspected that it would become a negotiating card that would be played time and time again in various negotiations throughout his administration.
Well, you both make it very clear in your commentary, he's going to have to give something up to get this.
Indeed. This is what we were getting at. What initiatives and things are close to his heart that he believes are going to work? Is he going to give up? And one thing we are saying, keep an eye on the EAA, the Education Achievement Authority. That might be something that he is willing to bargain on.
Well, it's already under some uncomfortable spotlights for corruption.
It has been, and has been controversial since it began years ago.
Right. If this is something that's become kind of an albatross around the whole school reform movement, it might be in Rick Snyder's interest for it to go away.
Why not?
But
get
if
rid
he
of it?
Can turn it into a legislative win, giving Detroit legislators, Democrats, a reason to vote for this, so they can go back to their constituencies and say, yeah, it wasn't everything that I wanted, but this was important enough that I felt it was worth putting up a vote for, then he's basically jujitsu'd that issue.
The political look at the battle to win legislative support for the Detroit Public School Rescue Plan from our It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. As always, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Cindy.
You bet.
What's up with these low gas prices? Patrick DeHaan of GasBuddy.com is here now. Patrick, I paid $1.79 for regular over the weekend. That was pretty sweet. What's the official average price per gallon for Michigan?
Well, across the state, we're looking at $1.91 a gallon. That's almost $1 a gallon lower than last year. Just in the last month, it's been about a decline of 25 cents a gallon.
And how does this compare to, like, how far back do we have to go to have had it this low?
the national average is about to dip to its lowest level since March 25 of 2009. It's going to be the cheapest Thanksgiving Day at pumps since about 2008, Thanksgiving Day of 2008. So we have to go back a long way to find these low prices.
Well, we'll take it. What's behind this welcome break in gas prices, Patrick?
Well, I would say three main factors. First of all, gasoline, oil production and inventories are very healthy. That's depressing the price of crude oil. That's certainly a chief ingredient in gasoline, as well as seasonal dips to gasoline demand. That helps as well. With demand relatively low compared to the summer, there's much more breathing room for the region's refiners. And that's the last part. Refinery maintenance season has generally wrapped up. Refineries generally do work in the fall after the summer driving season. That work is now wrapping up, allowing refiners to increase the amount of cheap oil that they're refining, and in this case, turning it into cheap gasoline.
Well, understanding that some world event or some maintenance issue at a refinery could crop up, but all things considered, you know, where we're at right now, what's the best guess for the foreseeable future?
I believe there's still a good chance that we would spend the rest of 2015 at or below an average of $2 a gallon. I think all the signs are there. There may be some days where, you know, the statewide average creeps closer to $2. There may be some stations across the state that, you know, dip down to the $1.50, $1.60 range. But most of the next month and a half or so should be spent at or below $2 a gallon.
It'll be very interesting to see what that means in terms of consumer mood, spending, and all of that that goes along with having a little more money in your pocket after you've left the gas pump.
Yeah, that's right. There are some big savings. Just comparing this Thanksgiving Day to last year, motorists are likely to save $1.5 billion if they hit the road Wednesday and get back Sunday night. So a big amount of money being saved as we travel for Thanksgiving this year, just compared to last year.
Patrick DeHaan with GasBuddy.com, bringing very, very welcome news for Thanksgiving travelers. This time we're going to say it was great to talk with you, Patrick.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Do millennials have a self-image problem? Research seems to suggest the answer could be yes, especially when compared to baby boomers and Gen Xers. And considering that millennials, that age group between 18 and 34, now make up the largest demographic in the American workforce, it's worth trying to understand why they think of themselves the way they do. So let's dig into this now as we say hello to John Cheney-Lepold, who's an assistant professor of American culture at the University of Michigan, and he is a card-carrying millennial. John, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with a study that was recently released by the Pew Research Center, and it found well over half of millennials describe their generation as self-absorbed. Just under half say they're wasteful. And 43% describe themselves as greedy. And when I read that, I thought, ouch, did that surprise you?
It kind of did and it kind of didn't. As a professor, I'm teaching a lot of the people in this cohort. And they have similar attitudes. A lot of the times that they project outward, that they're talking not about themselves, but they're talking about somebody else, which is then unsurprising that we see in that same Pew study that only 4 of 10 actual millennials identify as a millennial. The other 6 out of 10 identify as the Generation X or even the silent generation. 5% of all millennials polled were identifying as born from the 20s to the 1940s.
Isn't that something? Why do you think this is?
I think there's a lot of different reasons, obviously. As we see generations, we're not seeing really essences of who we are. We're seeing how certain groups, how certain age epochs,
cohorts
understand power, how they understand relations to the system. So during World War II, they were responding to certain conditions. During the 70s, they were responding to certain conditions, in the 80s and 90s. And now, right now, we have a very specific set of conditions as we see through war, as we see through threat of terrorism, as we see through economic problems, crisis, unemployment. That a lot of the ways that we like to approach these problems or situations is through saying that as a generation, they're going to deal with it together. So while you might be an independent person, the context you have and your social cohort, you're going to deal with those in a collective way.
Which I wonder, is that really any different from generation to generation? As a baby boomer, I think we came up through the 60s and felt very much
at odds with the previous generation, with the greatest generation, or the silent generation, and we felt we were in it together. You know, don't trust anyone over, you know, who's over 30, all of that kind of thing. Isn't this so it goes from generation to generation?
I think it is. And I also think that there's a kind of kids these days mentality that all of the ills of society we can put on the fact that kids are doing drugs, or they're not as active as we were, or they're not as progressive, or they're not as kind of labor intensive. That we see in that same Pew study, a lot of reactions to who are millennials. Well, the millennials are actually people who are less inclined to be part of political parties. They're less inclined to believe in religion. They're less inclined to exist within the kind of modern notion of what is a good citizen or what is a good laborer. And so they're at the whims of the market at the same time as nobody can look at them and say they are hardworking, even though they might be working three jobs.
Yeah.
That they don't have the career. They seem to be fluidly working and operating through life.
As a matter of fact, that only 12% of millennials describe themselves as patriotic. But then you think of what life has been like. They're the post 9/11 generation. Some of these millennials, these youngest ones, we've been in a war since they were 4 years old.
Yeah.
So there is an interesting sense that things worked pretty well for the baby boomers, but not so well for everybody since then.
Yeah, I think in a way, too, we're seeing the effects of, I guess we can think about this as global capitalism, as jobs get outsourced. In the baby boomer situation, you have jobs waiting for you when you come home. In the 70s and 80s, you are still having manufacturing in the United States. And then in the 90s and 2000s, that manufacturing goes away.
Yes.
Labor standards themselves become a little bit more frail. Welfare gets dropped out. Minimum wage obviously hasn't increased as it has historically. The context that a lot of people in my generation are living through is a context of precarity. It's a context of you don't really know what's going to happen next.
Now, but I will say, especially in the sense of national security, we had that growing up as baby boomers because we had the idea of the Cold War and worries about the atom bomb. And I can remember walking home from school during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was in second or third grade, but we were all talking about there might be a bomb. That's a pretty big sword of Damocles to hang over one's head.
I totally agree. I do think, though, at the same time, if you were of a certain socioeconomic status, you did go home to a family that had money, resources, owned their house.
True. In fact, the millennials really are the most diverse group of Americans ever. What are your thoughts as far as how race and class differences complicate this millennials are selfish media narrative?
Especially when we think about who is selfish in the world or who is greedy. Mm-hmm. I always go back to Gordon Gekko from Wall Street at Oliver Stone's Wall Street. And he says in 1987, greed is good.
Yes.
Greed is, for lack of a better word, good. And so Gordon Gekko, who understands in that movie how capitalist development works and how wealth is allocated, not because of democracy, but because of who owns it, controls it, and who controls it then determines where it goes, that we are seeing greediness being kind of offlaid onto the younger generation, that the people who created the crisis, the people who created the things that we are dealing with and the lack of jobs and lack of stability, those are the greedy people, I would think. The people who are polluting, the people who are going to war. If we think of self-absorption and greed, I would vote, if I was in this Pew study, as, well, it's probably the people in the 60s who are 60 and 70 who are controlling Wall Street, who are controlling the government. But the fact that people are putting it on themselves is interesting because it's almost as if you don't want to accept that you're screwed over. And there's a very interesting statistic from another Pew study that actually showed that while only 32% of all millennials have what we can say earn or have enough right now economically, 53% of those millennials think that in the future they will have that.
Mm.
So there's aspirational sense, this kind of what Steinbeck said is America is a nation of embarrassed millionaires, that sense of millennial almost privilege and I will get it sooner or later means that you can point the finger at everybody else who hasn't gotten it and say it's your fault because you're greedy or selfish, though I am sooner or later going to get mine.
I'm talking with Assistant Professor John Chaney Lippold, who is Assistant Professor of American Culture at the University of Michigan, as we look at the self-image that millennials have of themselves. And something that we can't ignore, John, is the fact that the thing that really distinguishes millennials from earlier generations is social media. So how do you think the social media habits of young people affects the way they're viewed by boomers and Gen Xers and the way they view themselves?
To go back to actually your earlier question to connect it, you asked about race, and I think that race is a very useful lens by which to see this issue in particular. That if we just take, for example, social media, that millennials are obviously going to be the ones who are most likely to be on social media, most likely to post, the most likely to take selfies. 55% of all millennials have taken a selfie. When you go to Generation X or you go to Generation Y, that just drops. Millennials, on average, they're supposed to have 250 friends on Facebook, and obviously, as you proceed through the ranks, those median number of friends drops.
But to say that in social media is this extraordinary space. It's like it's an environment where you can see all of these things happening and everything's going to happen with it. Millennials are not going to be a certain kind of person, but because all the millennials are on the internet, on social media, sharing themselves, producing information about themselves, it's really easy to cherry pick a certain example. Mm-hmm. This is to say that social media in one context is seen as damaging, is seen as self-absorbed. But we see social media operating in entirely different ways. I think Black Lives Matter, as a very particular example, lets us see while social media might be about posting a selfie or your cat, it also is about organizing. It's about having marginal voices have the ability to speak that historically they were unable to speak because they didn't have the gatekeeping function. They were disallowed participation in the mainstream media and politics. So when we think about how especially millennials are stopping or not participating in institutions, they're not participating in political parties, they're not being as patriotic, that might suggest a certain apathy in one frame, but in the other frame, it could be that they're actually doing something different. And I think with issues of Black Lives Matter, that you see this different kind of politics that is often not respected, but it totally is efficacious. And as we see, it's extraordinarily useful to how we have thought about race in the past 6 months.
And is that where you might see older generations slap back with all lives matter?
Yes. Yeah.
Where they don't get that that is an efficacious way of political activism and they kind of slap it down. Everybody's lives matter.
Yeah. And I think that everybody's lives matter refers to the sense that we are all equal in front of the state, that the government gives us all rights and we can do with those rights however we want. The idea of Black Lives Matter is historically, especially Black lives, have never had that affordance. Mm. And so in a similar way, we can see participation with political structures, that if only you vote, you will have a participatory voice. But no, after we've seen we've been disenfranchised. A lot of especially Black communities have been disenfranchised, but younger people in general have been disenfranchised as well. That this relation to the state, this relation to governance and being a good citizen has shifted from voting and just being polite to now potentially, you know, blocking an interstate or doing sit-ins or demanding, as the football team University of Missouri mm-hmm. did, mm-hmm. demanding that the president step down. That's a very aggressive form that can be seen in one hand as disrespectful. On the other hand, it could be seen, no, it actually worked. It's efficacious. And it's a new form of how we see politics that is engaging with a different kind of voice.
Is it harkening back to what we saw in the 60s with the sit-ins and the SDS? And, you know, I mean, right here at the campus of the University of Michigan when Tom Hayden and they were all gathering to do exactly what you're describing.
Yeah.
Is everything old new again?
In a way, because, I mean, weren't the hippies the most self-absorbed generation of that time? The idea of youth who don't wear suits.
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you don't wear a suit, then you are no longer part of America. Like, the idea of what is American is a very stable sense. It's almost hilariously consistent as we go through the decades. But America necessarily changes. Immigration. Mm-hmm. Just dynamics of culture. That what is cool today is not going to be cool in 5 years. But also, what is a good citizen today is not going to be a good citizen in 5 years, because that has to change as well.
What do you think? I know I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball, but let's add 30 years down life's journey for these millennials.
Yeah.
Do you think their overall view of themselves will improve as you let go of some of that youth angst that everybody goes through in their 20s?
I certainly hope not, but just in terms of how research has shown is that people love to dismiss and malign the younger generation. They love to say that the cause of the problems of our world are not the actual structures that run them, but the people who are at the whim of them. And that since they're not able to succeed, then it's their fault.
And we're not just talking the last few generations. Let's go way back. This is as old as time.
Yeah. The idea of kids these days is certainly something that we should think about. And when I get older, that's something I'm constantly reaffirming to myself. Like, do not blame the youth, because they're actually the ones who bring new ideas.
Don't be what you hate.
Don't be what you hate.
John Chaney Leopold, Assistant Professor of American Culture at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much. It was great talking with
you.
Even in these days of email, Skype, and FaceTime, we all know what the purpose of a post office is, to sort and deliver what we know is snail mail. But dig deeper. Just what story does that post office building tell about its community, about the people that depend on it? That's the question Lucy Blair asked. She and her wife and co-author Lina Blair set out to photograph each and every post office in the Upper Peninsula. It took them more than 4 years to do this, and it's told in their new book, Post Offices of the Upper Peninsula. Lucy Blair, very good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You and your wife live and work in Marquette, so you are UPers. I'm just wondering what led you to this idea of capturing images of every post office in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, we really love living here. And so we love being in Marquette, but we felt like we didn't know enough about the Upper Peninsula as a whole. We know that there's a lot to it, more than just Marquette. And so we decided to try to find a way to go to every town in the UP. And for us, it felt like the most definitive way to do that would be to see every post office. So, you know, we felt like post offices were a good thing because it would bring us to each town, because all towns have a post office. We kind of created a list ourselves based on the post office website, and then we just kind of went from there. And we saved that list in 2011 and stuck to that list, even though that list has changed over time.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that, because it certainly is a very critical time in the history of rural post offices. But first to what's in your book and the photographs. And I got to say, the variations in size and design are just stunning, from a huge, modern, big facility to the teeny tiny one in Cornell that's the size of a manufactured home, a.k.a. a trailer home. Which ones really surprised you?
You know, you kind of put the nail on the head, because we were just shocked at how some of these buildings are very clearly post offices, but in a lot of cases they either share buildings with other businesses, sometimes with libraries, sometimes even with a doctor's office, and so that really surprised us. But in terms of like specific post offices that surprised us or, you know, really stuck out, I think one of my favorites was the Ralph Post Office. And that was kind of at the end of our trip, and we went into Ralph, and we were looking everywhere for this post office, which happened a lot. We were always like looking for post offices, because some of these towns, they're in the middle of nowhere, so even just finding the town could be challenging. And so for this particular one, we couldn't find it, so we went into a bar and had to ask where it was, and it had recently shut down, and it had been moved since it had shut down to private property. And so we found it, and the guy whose property it was on was outside, and he stopped and talked with us, and he told us about how his grandparents had built it in the 60s because they felt that the town needed a post office. And so he had this whole history of the post office, and it was really cool. Even though it was closed down, he showed us inside, and he talked to us about what it meant to him and his family. It was a beautiful setting, too, because the trees behind it were super tall and so green, and it was just a really perfect moment, because for us, we got to talk to somebody there, and we really got to have conversations with him about what it meant to him, which kind of reflected what this project has meant to us too. And so it was just a really cool situation.
And Lucy, as you and your wife photographed these post offices, how many did you ultimately wind up getting into your book?
Yep, it was 134.
All right. And as you pointed out, you did this over these past 4 years at a really critical time in U.S. Post Office history. We know that the Postal Service has lost billions. Many of these small branch offices are closing or facing cutbacks in their operating hours. You've got many who think the federal government is just rearranging those deck chairs in the Titanic and ought to get out of the business of delivering mail. I'm wondering, what were your thoughts about the future of these branch offices as you went around the UP?
Well, and it's funny, because when we started, I didn't have any thoughts about it. You know, I just thought, oh, well, we're going to go take pictures of post offices. I didn't have any sort of like agenda or even real interest in what was happening. But, you know, when you're driving around to all these post offices and you see, you know, you can tell in some of the pictures people are coming out of them, and there's cars around them, and they're kind of hubs for these small towns. I really started to understand the role that they play in these communities, especially in such rural communities. You know, some places don't even have, you know, connected internet service. And so it was really fascinating to kind of see the role that they have in the community and how important they can be. And I learned a lot about how important the post offices are. And I think that, you know, it's a shame to see them closing and to even see the hours reduced because they can't have that significant role that maybe they used to. They do have a personality, and they reflect the personality of the towns that they're in. And some of these towns don't have a lot of resources. So
it is it's a very, very interesting book. And who knew that a collection of photographs of different post office branches could be so varied? The book's title is Post Offices of the Upper Peninsula, photographed and written by Lina and Lucy Blair. And we have been talking with Lucy, and I can tell, Lucy, it turned into a labor of love, didn't it?
It totally did. And it's so funny, too, because, you know, I never would have expected that when we started. But so much has happened, you know, between us in the last 4 years and then even just for the post offices themselves, that it really became something that it was trips that we loved taking. And it was every place we went, we fell in love with. And it just really did become this project that meant so much to us.
Lucy Blair, thank you so much for sharing your project with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
This month, a group of Michigan CEOs traveled to Israel. They were seeking a firsthand look at the business ecosystem in the country that has been dubbed Startup Nation. In just a few short decades, Israel has been transformed from virtually no business into one of the most active, innovative economies on earth. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes accompanied those CEOs to Israel. He is with us today, as is our partner in the next idea, Ross School of Business professor Jeff DeGraff. Daniel, take us a little deeper into who went to Israel and why Israel.
Well, it was a group of CEOs, as you said, led by Mark Murray, who's a co-CEO of Meijer, and Cindy Paskey, who had Strategic Staffing Solutions in Detroit. And you had a cross-section of people in different sectors, financial, automotive, construction, venture capital, a couple of people from, or at least the head of the MEDC here in Michigan was on the trip. And really the attempt was, or the idea was, to go to a place that has built a reputation for growth. How do they do it? What's the mindset? What kind of public-private partnership is there or isn't there? And Israel kind of really comes to the top there, and I think it was proven. The trip proved it out. It was. We saw an awful lot. We saw some surprises and learned some surprises. There was a few times when we were talking with government officials when there was gasps among the CEOs at some of the things that the government was doing. After what we've been through here in Michigan recently with the economic development and the pressure that a lot of know-nothing legislators are bringing to bear on them, it was a very refreshing change.
Jeff, what have you seen? You traveled around the world. I'm wondering what you have seen happening in Israel that is spurring all this innovation and fostering this really creative and entrepreneurial culture.
Well, Israel is the latest version of innovation ecosystems. And they start usually in these small countries. They don't have a lot of natural resources and they don't have a lot of time to get a runway on things. So what they have to do is they have to vertically integrate some things. And they often do this around what's called a sovereign wealth fund, right? A big amount of money that the government puts in, and then it allows investability from other people in the economy. I've been involved with a number of these over the years, like in Finland, which of course is hits way above its weight, Singapore, a lot of these places. But what's interesting is you need to really have a few pieces that go together. You need to have a great set of research universities, top flight, because you have to invent science. You have to start very early in the innovation chain with investigation and incubation. You have to have a lot of venture capital, which is what these sovereign wealth funds provide. And you have to have an amazing focus on science and technology. The challenge in all of these is to make them work, you need three things. And a lot of places have two of them, but not the third. And I'm very concerned about Michigan in this way. You have to have capital, venture capital, investable capital. And that's going to be a big issue, I think, for here in Michigan, because we have some, and we had sort of an engine for it, but it's been disconnected, basically. We have a governor who came from this community, deeply understands it, and a legislature that I thinks it knows more about this than the person who came from the community. Two, you have to have competency. And this is going to be a big issue in Michigan, which when you look at the adjoining states to Michigan, our percentage of 25-year-olds with a bachelor's degree or higher is relatively low. It's a bit of a scandal, if you will. And then three, and most importantly, you need a culture. You need a culture for innovation. And one of the things that Daniel's written about that I thoroughly agree with is that we used to have that culture. We used to have a culture of makers. And like a lot of people, I'm very concerned that culture is waning.
I would add a fourth thing I think that I saw in Israel, it's part of the culture, is there's a sense of purpose that we saw among a lot of these entrepreneurs. I mean, we heard time and time and time again, they live in a very tough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Their backs have been against the wall since that country was founded in 1948, even before then. One of the strains that runs through a lot of these entrepreneurs is that they all of them served in the military almost exclusively.
And something that came real clear in all the columns you wrote from Israel for the Detroit News is entrepreneurs there don't fear failure, do they?
No, we heard that time and time and time again. Now, that and as Jeff knows, that's not unique to Israel. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see that in Silicon Valley. People who know Silicon Valley very well will talk about failure as part of the currency. That's expected in a sense. But I think in their culture, it's very much expected. And as one guy said to me in a column I wrote recently, you know, once you've risked your life in the military, risking failing a business enterprise is really not a very big deal.
But here in Michigan, don't we, as you put it, tend to prize stability and certainty over risk-taking?
Yeah, and back to what Jeff said, I mean, the roots of this state are entrepreneurial. I mean, all the big companies, Ford, Dow, Meijer, Amway, Quicken Loans, Little Caesars, all these companies started as nothing. Right. But they grew up into these big behemoths, and that really, I think, informs the culture. Now, Dan Gilbert in downtown Detroit is drawing a lot of more entrepreneurial small companies there. And I think that space, there is some respect for that space in this state, the likes of which maybe I would have said didn't exist when I was covering business here 10 or 15 years ago. So there is more of it here. Mm-hmm. But I'm not I don't think it's where it needs to be. And there still is it skews big company.
Jeff Daniel used the term big company Michigan all in caps in one of his columns. Do you think our education system, our business schools have tended to train people to go out and land that dream job with the big company, you know, go work for someone else?
I think that at least where I teach, that hasn't been true for 20 some years. If you think about some of who my former students have been, create some of the biggest companies in the world. They just haven't created them here. Mm-hmm. I think there's two parts to something that Daniel said that's very interesting. When you start thinking about where these things have really gotten hold, these creativity clusters, we sometimes call them, there is compulsory service. I mean, think about Singapore and mm-hmm. the Malaysian War. Think about the Winter Wars with Finland. I mean, there is this notion of the wolf is at the door. And so that's an important thing. And the second thing is, in almost all of these cultures, none of the companies have turned into these behemoths. What they are is their turn cultures. And the reason is pretty simple. I mean, think about it. Is there an IBM in Israel? Is there a Boeing in Singapore? And the answer is no. And there's a bunch of reasons for this. We can get into this if you want to later. But one of the interesting things about this is, in order to do that, you have to have a very high churn rate, a very high burn rate. And you do that like a venture capitalist would. So what a venture capitalist would do is I'd give 10 people $10 million for the same disease state. They have different therapies. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to accelerate the failure cycle, not avoid it. Now, this sounds like it's a careless, reckless activity, except what I'm really trying to do is very quickly find out the one that's really an interesting product. So the notion is, instead of avoiding failure in the innovation, early innovation phases, you accelerate it. Now, this is what Israel has done very well, mm-hmm. maybe best in class, right? Mm. But here's what's missing. We don't have that bottom end of the economy, that incubation end here in Michigan anymore. And as we're trying to build it, there's no middleware connecting it back to the large-scale companies. That's what's missing here.
You're listening to The Next Idea as we talk with University of Michigan business professor Jeff DeGraff and Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel's just back from accompanying over 20 Michigan CEOs on a trip through Israel, getting a very up-close look at one of the most vibrant entrepreneurial climates in the world. And Daniel, the reports you wrote from Israel paint a very clear picture of sustainable economic growth that comes from these small new businesses supported where possible by private capital and business-friendly government policies. And you've made some comments at the beginning that I want you to get into a little bit more. Michigan doesn't compare so well when it comes to that, does it?
No, I think one of the most memorable meetings that the group had was with the chief scientist of the state of Israel, who is part of within the Ministry of the Economy. And as he sat and talked about the government programs that they pursue there. There were people that were astonished in the room. We had Doug Rothwell, who I believe is still the chairman of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and Steve Arwood, who is the CEO. And when this guy talked, his name is Avi Hassan, and when he talked about the fact that he has about $500 million a year that he is able to invest in startups. And of course, people around the room are astonished. Doug Rothwell points out, that's twice the entire budget of the MEDC for an entire year. And that's not all. The best part was when he said, and if an angel and an investor makes, let's just say, $100,000 investment, they get to write 100% off of it off against their income taxes in that year. Again, the gasp went around the room. And they are very unapologetic. A lot of these Israelis are they understand the American political system. A lot of them have lived in the United States. Some of them were born Americans. They get all of the American politics. And they basically – this guy looked at the group and said, well, that's fine. You just don't understand. This is strategic for our country. The failure creates other companies. And we're more likely to get four other companies out of a failure – then if we say, well, we can't invest in this company because the taxpayers won't like it. He said, taxpayers understand this is important.
And, Jeff, here we have our state lawmakers recently slashed MEDC's budget by 27%. We seem to be going the other way. So what's the right role for the state to play?
It's very interesting. There is a huge issue around tax that everyone, I think, has gotten wrong. And that is what low taxes do for you is they create employment opportunities at the bottom end of the pyramid. So if you're a mining state or an agricultural state, you want to have low taxes. But I'd ask a very simple question. What three states in the United States have the highest realizable personal tax rate? And they're Massachusetts, California, and New York. What three states by far have the most venture capital per person? They're the exact same states. If you're going to make the tax argument, you're making it upside down. So the notion is what you're trying to build in innovation is you have to build something that's a long horizon. It's not a short horizon. So you invest in research universities. You invest in these sovereign wealth funds, you know, the MEDC. You invest in technologies that look promising or strategically focused to the state. So we're a state that has a long history of automotive. I also think we have a long history of power generation. Water, we're the closest trading partner to Canada, which is 33% of all trade with America. So you have to look at where you're going in terms of what's happening 7 to 10 years down the road. And that's what Israel's doing. You can't look at, oh, the roads are bad, so I'm going to rifle all the long-term assets that we've got. And I think Daniel and I are on the same page about this. I think that's what's happened to us in the 1980s. That's what's brought us to the problem that we have. We were starting to see some remedies to this, and I think what's happened in the last few months has been disappointing.
I think you're right. And one other thing that struck me is there in Israel, there's a kind of a national sense of purpose that you get the impression is nonpartisan. But I think in Michigan, we are very much driven by the partisan, who's in charge. And we're going from pillar to post and pole to pole,
back and forth.
And, you know, I've made this point many times in columns about the road issue in Michigan. In the state of Ohio, you know, they spent on average about $1 billion more a year on roads. And if you talk to people in Ohio, they will tell you that whether it was Governor Bob Taft or Ted Strickland or John Kasich, there were certain economic development things that were viewed to be priorities for the state, not partisan priorities, priorities for the state. And I think you see that in other states as well. There's more, I don't want to say conformity, but more unanimity, more agreement on kind of basic infrastructure, economic development tools that benefit everyone in the state, not just one party or the other. We don't have that here, and we haven't had it for a long time.
Jeff?
I think there's an issue here that you're really raising that I think you're going to find anywhere in the world that you have these entrepreneurial environments, and that is there is a shared vision, and the shared vision comes from a sense of destiny. And I'd like the listeners here to go back in their time capsule and remember when we were going to go to the moon or we were going to lick the Russians. And whenever we have these inflection points, we seem to be able to get it. We get it. We you know, with the arsenal of democracy, all those things, we get it. The real question is, What is the shared vision now? What is the sense of destiny for the state of Michigan? Where are we going?
That's right. But I think the other thing, the other component about what you're talking about was courageous leadership. One of the things we saw in Israel repeatedly was a courage of leadership, was that government is not necessarily bad. It doesn't call all the shots. It's a partner. It understands and values the private sector and private investment. But it takes a position and it has a point of view and it leads. And it's willing to defend its positions and can defend them in many cases with results.
Lots that we've talked about here. Jeff, what do you take away for the state of Michigan? What kind of lessons do you think need to be applied to our state and how do we get there?
I think three things. Number one, focus. Focus on where we think we're going to get a lot of traction, not just gross new jobs gained, but net jobs retained. Because remember, when you start a lot of new companies, they also fail at a much faster rate. So kind of the mid section, the mid cap, the middleware we've been talking about, really focus on that. So power generation, trade with Canada, et cetera. Focus mm-hmm. on a few places as well. I think Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor, there are certain places in the state, Troy, you might want to put some of your attention. Two, you have to fully fund and be in for the long run on our sovereign wealth fund, on the MEDC. Fund it. Fully fund it. Not just fully fund it more. I think we need to be more aggressive about that. And then three, really focus on the emerging generation of entrepreneurs that we have here. Identify kind of the green berets, if you will, who can lead us all up that path. It's very much what Daniel said. We've got some leaders here. They've got some proven track records. Let's ask them. Let's follow them.
Daniel?
You know, I think there are a couple things that I would say. One is you need much more clear leadership and an ability and a courage to articulate a sense of purpose, a broader vision of where they want to go.
The long view.
Number two is I think Michigan has to understand that it has some phenomenal assets here. The auto industry is one of them. And it's not just making cars. It's engineering them. It's mobility. It's all the next generation kind of stuff that people around the world, including Israel, want to be part of. I think too many people have become too cynical in Michigan and they say, we need to get away from the auto industry. No, you don't. You need to double down on what's really important and understand that there are things you can lever. And third thing is government doesn't have to be the enemy. One of the things we saw in Israel is they can be a catalyst to change and they can support change in strategic ways, not do it for people, not write all the checks, but create an environment. And we talk about this time and time and time again about government can create an environment that can draw more kinds of investment and encourage people to become a player and to stay here.
Water the soil.
That's exactly right. And I think if I would say one of the biggest lessons, that's probably the biggest one coming from the week we spent in Israel.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. You'll find his reports from Israel at the website, DetroitNews.com, and Jeff DeGraff, University of Michigan business professor and our partner in The Next Idea. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Shelley Smith. Joe Lindstroth is the producer of The Next Idea. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.